Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Happy New Year, and welcome back to the first 2020 episode of Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols. We open this new year with a little bit of a look back on some of our favorite guests from 2019, on some of the themes that we thought remained very relevant as we turn the page on a new year and a new decade. First up, we revisit the talk that Jason and I had with Jennifer Tesher, CEO of the Financial Health Network, which at the time was known as the Center for Financial Services Innovation. We talk about their research and the work on financial health and wellness and some of the things that both consumers and financial institutions can do to improve it. Then we'll replay my interview with Richard Turin, author of Innovation Lab Excellence, about what organizations need to do to get real value out of their innovation efforts. We have some great new shows coming up over the next few weeks and throughout the upcoming year. As always, plenty of it will be tactical and practical, focused on the real-world issues that so many of our listeners are tackling every day in their own work. Jason has a new show about some of the latest developments in wealth management and wealth tech, and the whole team is working on new shows on AI, robotic process automation, payments, data access and availability, voice and mobile, cloud policies and practices, small business lending, ag tech, digital banking, and of course, innovation in many different flavors. And of course, we'll continue our occasional forays into science fiction, futurism, and the much broader world beyond financial services. Brett is in China this week with Jim Marus, and they'll be reporting on the ever-changing scene in China and in Asia. We'll be hearing about some of the themes that Brett has been exploring in his new book, The Rise of Techno-Socialism, on the broader impact of new technologies like AI and VR, and whether some of the economic theories, business, educational, political models, and policies may be in for some very dramatic changes as a result. We're also going to continue the expansion of the Provoke.fm media team beyond just the Breaking Banks show. In 2019, we launched Breaking Banks Europe, featuring hosts Matteo Rizzi, Paolo Cerrone, Megan Johnson, Nino Mahanti, Ajit Tripathi, Matthias Kroner, and Spiros Magaras. And they discuss what sets the fintech industry in Europe and the UK apart from the rest of the world. Regular guest Dara Tarkowski joined the team with her Tech on Reg podcast that explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industries. She talks fintech, regtech, sex tech, and more with thought leaders and entrepreneurs from around the world to share insights, trade viewpoints, and get us all thinking about responsible innovation. And we launched the Finovate podcast. Finovate has long been the leading fintech showcase for cutting-edge banking and financial technology through their global conference series. And now the conversation continues on Provoke.fm with the Finovate podcast with host Greg Palmer. We have a whole lot more in store for 2020, but for now, let's revisit a couple of those recurring themes.
Welcome, Jennifer Tesher, the CEO of the Center for Financial Service Innovation. And you know, Jennifer, I don't know anyone who's thought as long and hard about financial wellness as you and the team over at CFSI. And you've been at this for over 16 years, and your focus has expanded from the unbanked to include the underbanked. I think something you and I, when we met just over a decade ago, we had that discussion that the majority of the United States seems to be underbanked. I'm curious if you could share, how did CFSI come about? What's the founding story?
Sure. So glad to be on. And you're dating me. Actually, it'll be 15 years this April that. I founded the organization. But we have been at it for a long time. And when we started, we were about answering the question of how can the changes in technology improve access to financial services for those who need it most. And this was 2004. So Google went public that year. Mark Zuckerberg invented the Facebook in his dorm room that year. But we were pre-iPhone. And we didn't even quite realize just how ahead of our time we were. There was no fintech yet, or at least no word fintech. But there were millions and millions of Americans who either didn't have a bank account or who had one, but it wasn't really meeting all of their needs. So we spent the first roughly 10 years really focused on trying to spotlight on the needs of those consumers and making a business case to financial services companies, primarily banks back then, that this was a real market opportunity. It wasn't just like the right thing to do. This was a good thing to do from a business perspective. And then,
so not just marketing. This wasn't something that should sit in their marketing budget, that it was actually a business case under there.
Oh, absolutely. We demonstrated that people were spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on financial services and still not getting what they needed. So it wasn't a demand problem. It was a supply problem. So 10 years is a long time, and a lot happened in that 10 years. The iPhone was invented, making access ubiquitous. The financial crisis demonstrated that even if you had access, you still could be harmed. And the recession showed us that this was not a niche problem, that the majority of Americans were indeed struggling financially, and it was hidden from us in plain sight, if you will, in large part because people were significantly over indebted, but we were still looking at averages over the course of a year, as opposed to really deeply understanding the financial needs of consumers. And that's when we really pivoted to financial health.
So let's pick up on that pivot a little bit. What has changed over the past 15 years? You mentioned the advent of the technologies we all live with daily today weren't technologies that were even around 15 years ago. And we talked about the change of how the traditional financial institutions have been dealing with this. How's the mission evolved during the last 15 years?
The mission is, in many ways, has stayed the same. I think the biggest shift is that we realized that access alone wasn't really the problem, and frankly, wasn't sufficient. In part because of technology and the advent of things like prepaid debit cards, which 15 years ago were still called stored value cards, access has really largely been tackled, at least in the United States or other developed countries. So a very small percentage of people in America don't have a bank account. And of those, about half of them have had one at one point in time. They just happen to not have one when the survey person calls to ask them the question. So the challenges we have are not just about having access. Lots of people have access to bank accounts or to financial vehicles, but they don't have short-term savings. They don't have any retirement savings. They have too much debt. They have a poor credit score. They're not able to plan for the future.
So if the lack of access to the right kind of tools and products is not the problem, what do you think is the major problem in the U.S. or in developed nations?
I think that there are a number of structural challenges that have been decades in the making. Things like inequality, the fact that wages aren't keeping pace with productivity, and that much of the country really hasn't seen wage gains, certainly from an inflation-adjusted perspective, in 30 years. So now people are working multiple jobs and they're barely getting by. So there are a whole host of policy challenges and structural challenges that this country faces. But the fact is, those are going to take a while to solve. And people are really challenged right now. And so we really are both trying to change the understanding and the conversation about what business we're in as financial services providers, and to leverage technology to think about how we can give people tools right now to improve their day-to-day systems so that they can build resilience and pursue opportunity.
Yeah, in that need is very pronounced. Last year, for any listeners who haven't seen it yet, CFSI put together a survey for financial wellness in the U.S., and last year was the baseline year, and the results were sobering. 72% of Americans were either financially coping, which you defined
is struggling with some, but not necessarily all aspects of their financial lives, or were financially vulnerable, meaning they struggled with nearly every aspect of their financial lives. Were you surprised by the results of just how stark this was?
I wish I could say I were surprised, but after 15 years, nothing really surprises me anymore. I take that back. The only thing that surprises me is that there are so many people who continue to be surprised by these results, because I feel like we've been talking about them for so long. But we, many of us live in a bubble, and we don't realize that it's, you know, the person sitting at the reception desk when we walk in the office in the morning, or the person caring for our kids, or maybe it's a family member. But that this isn't necessarily the homeless person on the street. They've got very significant challenges. They've got a whole host of challenges. There are people who look like they have all the trappings of what would look like financial success. They have a job, they own a car, they have a house, they even have a 401k and maybe health insurance through their employer. But underneath all of that, they are one missed paycheck or one emergency away from a real crisis. And if we needed any real example of that, it would be the government shutdown.
Yeah. You know, as we were preparing for this, I was reading an interesting survey coming out of Germany. Does a financial wellness and a general well-being for the country survey. And in some of the comments, one of the things that I found really interesting was the concept in the U.S. around car ownership, that in most of Europe, if you look at income and the amount that goes to your vehicle, it's roughly 10%, and it scales actually very linearly with your income. So the fancy foreign cars are driven by executives and, you know, people who are at the entry level or still working to get by are more likely to have a used car, one with over 100,000 miles. And then the commentator pointed to the U.S., which they said it was just astounding to them that, you know, you find someone who's, you're working on the factory floor is driving, you know, the same car or a fancy truck as an executive who's making 10 times what they do. How much do you think this societal pressure is playing into some of the problems? Is it a problem of our own making?
That's a really interesting question. On the one hand, I absolutely agree that when you live in a country where 70% of GDP is predicated on consumer spending, that can't help but contribute to our values as a country and the fact that we have a savings rate that is as low as it is. That is not because we're just all profligate spenders. It's because that's the culture of this country, as opposed to, say, a Japan, where maybe they're oversaving. But on the other hand, I do think it's important to note that when we think about a healthy day-to-day financial system, it's really made up of two parts. One are those decisions and choices you make every day, and they are really important. But the other is also all of the hard stuff, I call it. Institutions, products, laws, the things that facilitate your ability to participate effectively. And it's got to be both of those things. Like, how many people do you know who have perfect access, could have choice of any product and service they want, they're white, and so they, you know, really have no issues at all, but they make really poor decisions and choices. But on the other hand, how many people do we know who, God bless them, they're doing everything right, but they just don't have access to the same systems, rules of the game, connections, networks, and so aren't getting the tools and help that they need.
Well, Jennifer, you've talked about some really huge and seemingly intractable problems. Let's talk a little bit about solutions and what you're seeing that is working. So if you could pick one thing you'd like consumers to do differently to help improve their financial wellness, what would it be? And then as a follow-up, what about the financial institutions? What's the number one thing they could do differently in your mind?
Mm-hmm. If there's one thing consumers could do, it's save. And I'm not talking about saving large sums of money. Mm-hmm. You know, the most often quoted statistic is the Fed stat that 40% of Americans couldn't come up with $400 in an emergency, which every time I hear it, I'm just blown away by it. Now, that number has improved somewhat over the last few years, but still 40%, staggering. And we're talking about $400. So if we could get everyone on the bandwagon to, over the course of time, put together a couple $100s, even $250, to have a little bit of a cushion in place, I think that would be so beneficial, particularly where we are right now in the credit cycle. I couldn't feel more strongly about this, given the timing, that it's not an if we're going to have a downturn, it's a when. And I doubt it will be, it will look anything like the last one we just had, of course not, but it was going to absolutely hurt Main Street America the most.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show last week, that, you know, we don't know exactly when or exactly how bad, but there's no doubt that this expansionary cycle ends at some point. And to your point, if we don't start getting some of these pieces in place now, it's only going to be harder when the economy turns south.
Well, and it is so frustrating, because the credit cycle being what it is, that it kind of happens the same way every time, and we seemingly never learn the lesson. Like, what are we doing to prepare for the soft landing, right? This is the time to, and you're seeing some companies do this, right? Pulling back a little bit on consumer credit, but frankly, not enough, right? Consumer debt levels are at, you know, all-time highs again. And it may not look like it did 10 years ago, but it's getting up there. So I just, everyone needs a couple $100 squirreled away somewhere.
Well, and so that's not a secret formula, right? It's a little bit like weight loss. We all know what we need to do to lose weight. You know, it's eat less, move more. So what are some of the things that, as a consumer, they could use as a tool to help? Have you found, you know, because awareness, it doesn't seem to be the problem.
Totally.
It's the actual making the change. Are there some tools out there you've seen? You know, CFSI runs its labs out of San Francisco that really does a great job of curating startups that are focused on this. Are there banks that you think are doing a particularly good job? How can we actually get the consumers the help they need?
Yeah. You know, could you imagine, like, if we were doing this show 5 years ago, could you imagine that we would have seen the explosion of innovation in short-term savings that we've seen? I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? Because no one thinks about this as being a real business opportunity. But I think that people are so hungry for tools to help them be their best selves that there's a real market for these tools. So we were an early investor in Digit, which was this idea that I give the company access to my checking account, and they use algorithms to see my cash flow, and they kind of crawl around looking for this hidden change, if you will, in the cushions of my bank account, and then sweep it over to savings, really without you having to think about it. And so we're seeing lots of flavors and versions like that. Then you have Acorns, you have folks who are doing things around Roundup. Fifth Third just announced Dobot, not really sure about that name, but also an opportunity for small savings. So you're right, this isn't rocket science. It is behavioral economics and thinking about how to create the right incentives to, again, help us be our best selves. But there are just tremendous number of tools out there right now.
Well, tremendous tools, and they do a great job, you know, using Digit as an example, where they can help take the friction out by automating some of this. And when you look forward, think about some of the new technologies coming on the horizon, you know, there's all the promise of, you know, AI and personalized, you know, bots and things like that. Do you think that's going to be part of what helps turn this around? Or, you know, is that just false promise?
I think it remains to be seen. I'm an optimist. I do think that I care a lot less about intention than I do about outcome. So don't get me started on the topic of financial literacy and education, but, you know, it's not about what you know, it's about what you do. Yeah. And to the degree that machine learning can decomplexify, I just made up a new word, people's financial lives, the stuff that takes up way too much brain space, and lets us focus on the things that are that really require our engagement, I think the better off we'll be. Now, I think the challenge is that there are patterns in people's financial lives, but they are, if not infinite, then they are extraordinarily varied, and those patterns are inconsistent. So maybe they're not even patterns, right? I'm hoping that the machines can find the patterns in the inconsistency. But people's, not only are people's incomes increasingly volatile, their expenses are volatile. The whole, 80% of our expenses are fixed. That's a lie. It doesn't really work that way. And so when you see firms trying to really understand people's financial lives and to be able to make some of those automated decisions, it's a lot harder than it looks. And I think we're only in, you know, the second or third inning of that game.
It's interesting, this idea of, you know, the volatility is only increasing, and that actually will make it harder to pick out the patterns, right? If it's not reproducible, how do you actually help structure those choices for the consumers and use the behavioral economics? And I wonder if the part we need to focus on isn't the financial end of the, you know, the whip that's going on, but we need to fix some of the behavioral, you know, at the outset, because part of what you got me thinking about is I've seen some very cool apps out there that help people change their neuroscience, and specifically around addiction, by looking at triggers and why they make choices and what they're feeling when they make those choices. I wonder if, you know, part of the solution here isn't just dealing with the money. It actually has to start at a much deeper root to change people's psychology towards it.
That's really interesting. I have mixed feelings about that. I think that there absolutely are things called financial personalities. We each have different personalities. And on the one hand, I believe that people have the capacity for growth and change. And I also think that there are some things about us as humans that are hardwired. Having two children, right, raised in the same household, produced by the same two parents, but are totally different humans, right? Sort of gives me this appreciation. And so it's not clear to me kind of where the line gets drawn. The other reason why I have mixed feelings about it is because I worry very much about this blame the victim thing. So we have to focus on people's behaviors and choices, but we risk going too far down that road and not thinking about the challenges we're putting in people's way.
Well, and I think that goes back to one of the underlying points where we have to look at those challenges we've created systemically.
Correct.
And, you know, and parts of that can be access, parts of that can be education. You know, and the other parts, frankly, are, you know, how we set up the way expenses and things, you know, from insurance and healthcare and others become real structural issues all along the way.
Right. And you know, it's a little bit like something as basic as jobs, right? What is work going to look like in this country? What does it look like today? And even if all the machines don't need our jobs, right? Like, work is just changing. And in some ways it could be good for people. And in a lot of ways, it's not so great for people. And we've got to grapple with that. And I think that financial services companies and fintechs should have something to say about that. But beyond the broader policy implications, we've got to think about what does it mean when people are working multiple jobs and have multiple income streams and may not actually be formally employed by anybody. What does that mean for getting a mortgage, as an example?
Yep. Oh, dear. Don't make me relive that, having been self-employed over the last 15 years. It's reason number two not to ever, you know, move our house again.
Yes, or to be married someone who is gainfully employed. My husband is self-employed, so I understand the challenge.
Yes.
Well, I think part of what we're talking about here is stress. And, you know, survey after survey around these things talk about the degree of stress, the percentage of people, you know, over half of people are feeling stress. They're feeling it in the workplace. So it's impacting productivity at work as well. I mean, what are the kinds of things that you're working on to help not only improve the actual activity and the savings rate, but help to reduce the stress in consumers today?
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because stress is toxic. It's literally, for many people, significantly contributing to why they are physically ill. And there's a very significant link between physical health and financial health, and it's bi-directional. And so if you think about employers who are on the physical wellness bandwagon as a way to reduce their own healthcare costs, it's a little bit like bailing a leaky boat if they're not also addressing the financial stress and financial challenges of their employees, because often that's what's contributing to their being sick. I really increasingly believe that financial health is everyone's responsibility, and that really everyone has a stake in it. The employers have a stake in it because it impacts productivity. Schools, universities, colleges have a stake in it because it's what's impeding graduation. I mean, think about it, 70% of community college students drop out, many of them after already taking on debt. That's horrifying, right? Hospitals and healthcare systems increasingly are being reimbursed by keeping people out of the hospital and out of the doctor's office. Well, how do you do that? You've got to be thinking about the broader array of issues that people are facing day to day. So at the end of the day, I think this is really all about changing the understanding about the role that we all play in promoting financial health, and that this is actually of national import.
Well, and you brought up two things I was going to ask you about is, rising education expense and student loan debt and rising healthcare costs and, under insurance. From all the work that you've done and the research that you've done and seen, is one or the other really a bigger driver? Which one would you tackle first?
You know, I don't think we have the luxury of picking,
right?
Unfortunately. The interesting thing about the student debt is that it affects both this generation that's graduating and coming into the workforce, but it's also affecting their parents, in some cases their grandparents, who have co-signed. So you hear about these people who decades later are still carrying debt around, and it's not always their own, it's their kids' debt. And I do think the student debt is causing other kinds of developmental things to come later and later, which is not necessarily a positive. But on the other hand, like, healthcare is your life, and it's about longevity. And I think in both cases, they're not just important because they are, they're both about creating opportunity, but also how do you create that opportunity without being chained to debt. They also, there are big gaps between people of color and other non-dominant groups in outcomes in both of those arenas that we really have to tackle if we're going to make any progress.
You took this to a great place, Jennifer. Like, you've got my mind, kind of spinning along several dimensions, and I think this went deeper than we expected. What's the one point, if we were to end on here, what do we drive home with people? Is there one takeaway?
I would presume that most of your listeners are actually in the financial services or fintech world. And to them, I want to say, this is what your customers want and need from you. They want help with these issues. You can't really say you're in the financial services business and then not actually be interested in the financial challenges of your customers. And so this is, I believe, the basis of competition. in financial services and fintech in the future. And those who get there first are going to be most likely to succeed.
The financial pulse, you know, really is a great leading indicator here. What's your intent? You know, where do you see, now that we have a baseline established in 2018, how do you see these metrics being used to drive change?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. You asked me earlier, what's the one thing I think providers should do? And right now, I think it's measure, because what gets measured gets managed. And we like to think we know a lot about our customers, but the fact is, my experience is that we don't. We certainly don't know about their day-to-day financial lives as much as we think we do. And how can we possibly build strategies and businesses and customer experiences that are going to make money by helping people improve their financial health if we don't know where they stand? We're working with dozens of financial services and fintech companies. They're part of our Financial Health Leaders Program, in which they're using our methodology and 8 indicators of financial health internally, either with their customers or their own employees or both. And the Financial Health Pulse offers a national benchmark for how their customers or employees compare to national and regional data. This is going to be longitudinal data, which is really exciting. So we're not just going to be doing the same survey over year over year, but to different people. The majority of people we will survey each year will be the same. There is no longitudinal data out there today. And then I think the last thing that's incredibly exciting about this work is we are just about to start gathering transactional data from some of the survey respondents. And that you can gather more frequently than once a year. It's going to give us an incredibly wholesome picture of people's financial lives, and it's going to ultimately enable us to start modeling what moves the needle. That's going to really help people leverage the pulse and our measurement tools to ultimately drive change and bottom line revenue at their institutions.
Well, it's time to take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Well, I'm here with Richard Turin, author of Innovation Lab Excellence, Digital Transformation from Within. So, Rich, welcome to Breaking Banks. Tell us a little bit about your background. I know you have a banking background and you ran IBM Cognitive Studios, but tell us more about your background and why you wrote this book.
Sure. I started my career out in banking, and I did 20 years on trading floors, not as the guy who says buy, sell, but the guy who actually designs the products. Mm-hmm. So I worked with a team of people who were essentially computer coders. And what we did was what we would now call B2B business. So basically taking computers and taking technology and using them to build products for our clients. So after essentially 20 years or just short of 20 doing that, I moved to China after the financial crisis, which spelled the death of my business, and eventually lined up with IBM, where I ended up heading their innovation labs for fintech down in Singapore. So going ahead to Singapore, what I saw that was really fascinating was that my clients were other innovation labs, because what I sold were IBM's AI product and also their specialist analytics services. What I saw were many young people at the labs who were terribly unhappy. And then on the other side of the equation, I saw senior managers who were responsible for labs not happy with what they saw from the labs. So a career in banking followed by this seeing so many unhappy people working in and around labs.
Well, I share part of your background as a recovering banker myself, and I really enjoyed your book. I thought you brought up a number of excellent points, and you have a number of best practices that you offer for those running innovation labs, and we're going to get into some of those today. Now, before we do that, though, let me just say, but you stayed in Asia, and you're in Shanghai now?
Yes, I've been almost a decade in Shanghai and Singapore. So the actual count is 2.5 years in Singapore and seven and change up here in Shanghai. It's just been a wonderful ride, and China for fintech is the place to be.
Well, that's certainly one of the things Brett talks about all the time on the show, and I don't spend as much time as I'd like, but I'm in Asia at least a couple of times a year, and I come away with the same experience. So it does bring a kind of a certain perspective for looking at innovation and in fintech. Now, in your book, you differentiate between R&D or Skunk Works and your vision of a digital innovation lab. Can you talk a little bit about the difference and what you mean about a digital innovation lab and how that's different?
Traditionally, if we look at a consumer products company, for example, or a food products company, they've had innovation labs where they test flavors or where they test a new product out. Digital innovation labs are perhaps descendants of these organizations, but are fundamentally different. What they strive to do is to bring digital transformation into a company. In what I would like to think is the least painless way possible. But we have to think about digital products as having a very short lifespan, and quick setup time. So what we're looking for is not R&D for a pharmaceutical that takes 10 years to launch a new cancer drug. We're looking at a facility that is designed to bring new digital products up and online within the period of months or shorter, smaller fractions of a year.
So within fintech or financial services, do you think most people are getting that mix right?
Oh, absolutely not. I felt that I was doing a social service by trying to write the book because I saw so many people were unhappy. It's really funny. If you talked to lab people, and particularly the young millennials who are working in the labs, many, many of these millennials are grossly unhappy because they want to do more and they feel that they can't within the structures of the large organizations they're working in.
Is that a function of the structure or the leadership or both?
Yeah, all of the above. It's a function of it's a function first and foremost of expectations and the structure of the organization. So the structure is generally that the innovation lab is held as a separate unit outside and apart from the business units and the daily money-making activities of the bank. What happens is the innovation lab is apart and it's out of touch. And it really doesn't understand what everybody else is doing to make a living in the bank.
But it's a bit of a conundrum because on the other hand, if they're not somewhat separated, then you talked about this in your book too, they're kind of dragged into very incremental improvements that just kind of extend the line of business as usual. So how do you get that balance right?
That's the tough part. The issue really comes in with if you don't separate the lab, then you have, say, business people looking over the shoulders of the lab people, and their job is to experiment. So if their experiment fails, people will say, look, the experiment failed. You guys don't know what you're doing, you digital people. So you do want some separation, but a physical separation is great. Having your own space is great. I'm all for this. A physical separation is fine. But that there is an intellectual separation as to the purpose and the mission that the lab has relative to the other business units seems to be one of the larger problems that I see out there. So the labs are not aligned in what their purpose is and how they should be serving and servicing their clients, who are essentially the business units of the bank.
Yeah, we see the same kind of thing, and my partner Jason likes to talk about one of the banks that we worked with where the outcome was everybody in the bank knew that anything that came out of the lab, that was a signal to immediately reject it because it must be a bad idea. It was from those disconnected people who the bank had hired separately and managed separately.
Yeah, look, just imagine the following scenario. You're in what is essentially one of the most highly regulated industries in the planet, right? You then hire a bunch of digitally enabled young people. And by and large, most of the lab employees are young. So you then tell them to go be creative. And then when they start turning out ideas, you basically say, oh, well, we couldn't possibly use these ideas because they don't fit into the regulatory spectrum or other constraint by which the business units operate. So you've got sort of you've got this problem where there's a mismatch. So the real solution to this, or one potential solution, is to really get the young people who are in these labs trained up as to what happens in the rest of the bank. So yeah, I've lived and I've seen so many times the exact story that you told, where the rest of the banking group looks at the innovation guys and they say, oh boy, here comes trouble. We're never going to use any of that stuff.
Right. It's guaranteed to be disconnected from the reality of the business and our regulatory needs and so on. And you also talk about, there's a parallel story here in one of your best practices. You say flip the hackathon, and you paraphrase the assessment of several hackathon winners that you talked to. They said essentially, we had to show everyone in the bank how our system worked. We explained it dozens of times to people in multiple departments, and in the end, we gave away all of our IP and got nothing in return. They wouldn't buy our systems because of compliance issues, but we still had to teach them everything we know. So it doesn't sound like a very good partnership when this is, you know, one of the hottest words in fintech these days, right? We're going to partner with you.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what to do with it, but there's this problem in the hackathon universe, and that is that most of the institutions that host these events really have very little plan for what they're going to do afterwards. And in fact, you can really look at many of these events as nothing more than corporate PR exercises. So they do a hackathon, a bank does a hackathon, they get all these young people, they participate, they launch the videos, they get great publicity, they hail all of the winners as geniuses, and there's no follow-up. There's no money to set the systems up. Better that they just go hire a startup. Yeah, I know they won't get the PR buzz out of it, but as far as contributing and getting something back to the bank, go hire a startup and have them do a POC for $100,000. It'll be a better deal.
Right. This is a cousin to something else you talk about that I talk about all the time. Anyone who hears me on the show, I talk incessantly about innovation theater, and you cite that as one of the reasons that labs fail. It's really kind of related to that same problem, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's look at it from senior management perspective for a moment. Innovation has value. It has PR value and helps float your stock price, helps create the impression of being progressive. So on one hand, we've got this tremendous drive for the most senior managers of the company to push innovation, to make it really look good. And then on the other hand, there's the reality of innovation, which we just spoke about, which is these young millennial staff who are trying to bring technology in and are, as we discussed, voted the most likely to have your business unit run away from. I mean, because they propose solutions that many of the business unit leaders can't use. So pushing on one side, a pushing on the other side to try to get things done that can't be done, and you've got a stage that's set for unhappiness where one side says we're doing great things and the other side says we can't do anything.
Right. Well, let's talk about some solutions, because I think you lay out some good practices in the book. And one of the things that you talk about that I think dovetails into what you're just saying now is the need to calculate ROI. And as you say, doing so in innovative ways should be encouraged. How should innovators think about calculating ROI? Because using the same metrics we use for fully established and mature products is usually not a good method.
Look, there's a lot of discussion within the innovation community about whether ROI is or is not a useful measure. If you're working in the banking environment, There is nothing else. You have to use it. So you have to use ROI, but you have to learn how to use it creatively. And that essentially means using soft numbers, meaning that there's hard dollar numbers, which are clearly equatable to dollars in saved costs for client servicing or from some other metric that is hard and real. But we also have to look at new metrics or softer metrics, and to add them into the equation somehow so that they get calculated and they make a contribution. So yeah, you don't want to put any of our innovation products under the boot, if you will, or under the strict constraints of traditional ROI calculation. But of course, you need to be creative and think of other ways to find soft money and benefit and to calculate an imaginary dollar benefit value to those benefits, and that's probably the only way that within a banking institution you're going to get innovation products through the cost and the funding hurdles.
Well, in the book, you cite an example from DBS Bank in Singapore and their Emma chatbot. Can you talk a little bit about that and how they looked at hard and soft dollar ROI?
Yeah, it was a great example. And it was OCBC Bank. What they did was...
Oh, sorry.
Really,
I cited the wrong Singapore bank because I know you talked about DBS as well.
I talk about them both. Emma was a really great example because I got to talk to the sponsor for this, and what they were able to do and what they've been public in doing is citing the number of people who have been served by Emma the chatbot, how many correct answers. And what they've been able to do is to set up a series of metrics that basically give some value to Emma's services. So if anybody is asking the question, should we keep Emma alive and should Emma be paid for? Well, the people who are running it say, look, Emma has answered 2 million questions, 88% of them it's answered correctly, and that saved X number of manpower hours from our call centers where these things would have gone. Now, you can say that the saved hours to a call center, that's clear, and that's a clear, calculable, and hard dollar metric. But the number of correct answers and the number of questions or people served, these are softer metrics. And what the sponsor of the Emma chatbot was able to do to get the project off the ground was to work with these softer metrics and to take soft dollar metrics and use them as one of the ways that the project would pay for itself.
Well, but at the same time, you talk about, and correctly in my mind, avoid the big plan is one of your best practices. And because you say the big plan is often heavily tech-centric rather than people-centric. And you talk about, you know, not making too big of a bet on any one technology. And I think Emma was an example of technology that they were able to repurpose from prior experiments. But talk a little bit about what are the best practices around avoiding the big plan and maybe an example of who does that well.
You know, it's really funny. There's a lot of labs that are functioning relatively well. And if I was to make one distinction between the labs that function well and those that don't, it would be that the good, well-functioning labs have lots of little projects that are always percolating through the system. And then I'll get to another lab, and that will be the lab that has what I call the big plan. They are going to change everything. That plan is so big that the bank will not exist in the current state in another 2 years if just we could get a little more money and a little more manpower working on the big plan. So what that usually is a innovation lab that has dedicated itself to some form of tech, and they are thoroughly all in, 100% all in on that tech, and that tech will have profound relationship to changing the institution. Now, it's a great goal, but the reality is all during this period, the lab doesn't show any forward motion in innovation. It doesn't have any small successes that it can point to. And the entire staff is dedicated to this one very, very super large mission, rather than a series of small successes that come one after the other, which is the more favorable and the more productive way of running a lab.
Right. And I think that plays into one of your other points, too, and that is that internal teams should think more about transformation rather than disruption. Share your thoughts on that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. One of the problems that I see over and over is, and this is not the, I'll preface this by saying it's not the fault of young people being young and being digitally savvy, but there's sort of an insensitivity that many labs run around within their organization, and they say, well, we're going to disrupt. Fine. You're talking to a 18-year or 20-year veteran of the bank who's got a career that has vested in the institution, and you tell them that you're going to disrupt their operation, their sales team, their right. group. And, you know, it doesn't make for a lot of friends. And I think oftentimes that the people in the innovation lab business are insensitive to the fact that when they talk about disruption, what other people are hearing is job loss. I'm being laid off. I've done something wrong. I haven't kept my group current with what's going on. So what I always tell labs is, please use the disruption word as infrequently as possible and use transformation. Transformation is a better word because it's really what you want to do. You want to transform from a non-digital operation to a digital operation. You don't necessarily want to disrupt everyone and everything around you. It's a loaded word that may cause more harm than good.
Well, and like so many other hot buzzwords in our industry right now, it's one of the most misused words. And I can't tell you how many times I hear a bank executive say, well, you know, you have to disrupt yourself before somebody else disrupts you. And that's not actually the right thing. You don't want to disrupt yourself, to your point. You want to transform yourself. You want to give yourself options. You also want to keep the existing business going as long as you can because it has certain built-in advantages to the structure that you already have. And so from the C-suite's perspective, from the shareholder's perspective, it's not about disrupting yourself. It is about trying new ideas. And then and even the transformation word, I mean, arguably that happens you know, more often than it used to, but that's still not a, you know, we don't transform ourselves every other year or something. That's a pretty long-term kind of target.
You know, it's really interesting. If you don't make your staff happy, and if your staff, your existing staff that's built your current business, if you don't transfer successfully their IP into the digital world, you've got nothing. So let me take a step back and re-explain this. Your staff, your current staff, is the gold mine. They are the people who contain the information that needs to be transformed and put into some form of digital fashion. So if these people are not on board, and if these people are not made an integral part of this exercise, there's nothing left. What can you go digital with if you lose or do not have the fantastic resources that have built your company for many years? So talking about disrupting, saying you have to disrupt yourself, is really scary business. Transformation and taking the IP that you have and transforming it into something new, that's a wonderful goal and a more attainable goal.
Right. I think Clayton Christensen coined the phrase well back in 1997 when he called it the innovator's dilemma. And people get the disruption part. They know the stories about Kodak and Blockbuster and Nokia and so on. But it is a dilemma because I've got a real life business and real life customers generating profits this quarter. So how do I keep that going while I'm also trying to transform myself?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the... There is a timing issue that we have to deal with. And many businesses, including banks, can, will, may be disrupted, sure. But there will be this gray period in between. And it's that in-between period that we have to deal with. And we have to take the IP of the people who are currently in your bank and transform that into a digital package somehow. And that's going to be not something that's done over 2 weeks. It's something that's going to be done over a number of years. And there's going to be a large transitional period before you get there. And keeping your staff happy and keeping your existing operations going, that's going to be key. And the managers who can do that and make that transformation, I think are going to be well rewarded, but it's far and few between.
Well, it is a balancing act. You also talk about one of your best practices is using discipline project management. And in my experience, I would argue that banks are maybe a little bit too good at discipline project management because they want everything to have a project charter and an owner and a budget and a Gantt chart and everything else. And innovation doesn't always work that way. So what is discipline project management in the scope of a digital innovation lab in the way that we've been talking about it today?
Oh boy, that's probably the toughest question. How about I wrote the book, but I have no idea. No, yeah. The answer is really it's hard. Basically, innovation loathes a schedule. So there's no innovation project that I've ever worked on that didn't have a delay or didn't have some problem associated with it. And, you know, and that's normal. And you're right. So again, this goes, if you put an innovation project under the Gantt system and under the very, very detailed project management that some banks may have, yeah, it's not going to fit because the activities don't happen on schedule. Innovation doesn't happen on a timeline.
Right.
So the, you know, the simple answer is you need to have, I think more important than the timeline is the sensation of when to pull the plug. When is some project not working, even if it's ahead of schedule or within the allotted time? Do you burn all of your time on a project if you've got a really good hunch that it's this thing isn't working out early on? And to me, the discipline project management is knowing when to, is more about when to call it quits.
I think the other thing you talk about that I definitely agree with is you just talk about learning, right? Are we still learning? Are we learning something? We may have not have hit a deadline that we thought we were going to hit up front, but if we stop learning, that's certainly time to stop a project as well. So Rich, maybe last question here. I've cited some of the best practices that you have in your book, but give us at a high level, what are these best practices really all about?
Sure. I'm delighted you asked that because I'm not trying to make rules for your lab. In fact, I was very clear. I thought about this. I didn't want to make a rule-based system because labs are all so different that you could not have one set of rules that would work for all innovation labs. But best practices are essentially things that you can do that, if they apply to you, can make your lab environment run more smoothly. And what's behind each best practice is essentially a conversation. Now, let me make this clear. The stakeholders in your innovation lab, there are essentially three. There are obviously more, but the three big ones are going to be the lab employees, the senior management who sponsors the lab, and the people from the business units who have to use the lab. Now, what the best practices are all designed to do is to start an organized discussion between these stakeholders. So basically, just imagine the scenario where the lab people are having some problem. They pick up the book, they go to best practice number 7, and they say, hey, our problem right now has this problem. You can give the book to the other shareholders, say, can you please read chapter 7? And basically, it starts a discussion. So the best practices, each one of them is a discussion to be had among the shareholders that hopefully makes the lab experience better for everyone.
I think these are all good best practices for anybody running an innovation lab. And I think people should definitely read your book, Innovation Lab Excellence, Digital Transformation from Within. Richard Turin, how can people get the book or learn more about you?
Sure. The book is available on Amazon, and more about me on richturin.com. That's, and the Turin part has two R's.
That's, I was just going to say that.
U-R-R-I-N. So Tango, Uniform, Romeo, Romeo, India, November in pilot speak.
Very, very good use of the NATO alphabet there. As Nichols with no H, I try to get people's names right. So Richard Turin with two R's, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks again to Jennifer Tescher from the Financial Health Network and Richard Turin, author of Innovation Lab Excellence. Their work remains relevant as ever. As always, if you like the show, the single best thing you can do is give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps spread the word to help new listeners find the show. And don't forget, you can listen to all of our more than 300 shows, plus episodes from all of our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, and the Finovate podcast, all on Provoke.fm. That's it for this week, and we'll see you again next week for more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.